online 24/7. This is the radio industry's very own radio station. In Radio.
Hello and welcome to Third Sector on In Radio. This edition of the programme reflects a busy autumn in which I have sallied forth with my microphone, capturing a range of really fascinating conversations. Coming up on the programme, the former Minister for Radio, the European Chief Executive Officer of a global charity that encourages voices to the marginalised and empowers local and independent media. I've also got some great stories of how involvement and participation in radio has had a very dramatic impact on people's lives and their opportunities. Here's what we've got.
Online 24/7 and worldwide in radio.
When I came into government in 2010, obviously we had absolutely no money and the emphasis was on cutting budgets, and the community radio budget was tiny, in the few hundred thousand, and obviously there was pressure even to cut it further or possibly even get rid of it. So I fought very hard to protect it because I took the view that a little money goes a long way, and to cut this money would be a false economy. You know, if you cut £100,000 from a £400,000 budget, you're not going to get rid of the national budget deficit, but you would have a big impact on community radio.
I think we gave him a lot of encouragement, which he'd never had before. We played to his strengths rather than his weaknesses.
I think there's a risk that sometimes people look at, you know, radio as being a bit old-fashioned, or even the concept of community media as being old-fashioned. And actually, I think in this country, I think the evidence suggests quite the contrary. There is a vibrant, significant body of the population here that still listen to radio at least once a week, or more often than not, every day.
And the presenting side came from giving public speeches for Great Ormond Street Charity about my experience in hospital. I gained a lot of my public speaking confidence there.
I'm Dom Chambers, and there's something of a reunion feel to today's edition of the programme, as I meet up with Ed Vasey MP, who I last saw in a studio at Wolverhampton Community Radio. That was in January 2015, on the day that the Department of Culture, Media and Sport, of which he was a minister at the time, announced the Community Radio Amendment Order. So good catching up with him, and that conversation to follow shortly. I also take a clip from my summer community radio tour when I popped into Chorley FM and Barbara Lowe tells me a wonderful story about one of their volunteers. I also chanced upon Daniel Bruce recently at the Community Media Association's AGM in Leicester. And in fact, it was when I was chairing that organisation that I first met Daniel, who is the European CEO of Internews, when we were both attending the UNESCO Conference on Community Media Across the World in Paris in 2015. And we're here from Jake Peach, who's an undoubted emerging radio talent, both on-air and managerial, when I dropped by to see him at CSR FM when I was in Canterbury back in September. But it was more recently, on one of those lovely dry winter evenings, that I took a stroll out on London's South Bank, over Westminster Bridge and into Portcullis House, where I sat down with a fellow radio enthusiast.
Ed Vasey, MP for Wantage and former Minister for Radio.
Now, Ed, last time we met, we were in very different positions. You were the Minister, number two at Department of Culture, Media and Sport, and I was the chair of the Community Media Association, the national representative body for community media here in the UK. And actually what we were talking about then was the Community Radio Amendment Order, and I suspect our interests have stayed the same, with our job descriptions have moved on a little bit. You were the minister for 6 years, and that oversaw, you had a lot of things to do with your brief, but that oversaw a massive expansion of community radio in the UK. What is your reflection of your time in office from that viewpoint?
Well, I guess the expansion was a bit of a miracle because when I came into government in 2010, obviously we had absolutely no money, and the emphasis was on cutting budgets, and the community radio budget, the sort of central grant that supported community radio, was tiny, in the few hundred thousand, and obviously there was pressure even to cut it further or possibly even get rid of it. So I fought very hard to protect it because I took the view that a little money goes a long way, and to cut this money would be a false economy. You know, if you cut £100,000 from a £400,000 budget, you're not going to get rid of the national budget deficit, but you would have a big impact on community radio. And I always took the view as well that community radio was a good thing. It was created, in effect, by the Labour government under their Communications Act, but I didn't take a partisan view. I didn't take the view that because the Tories didn't invent it, it was therefore a bad idea. I took the view that they'd done a good thing and created something very good. So I wanted to support it as much as possible. And I was very pleased that by protecting the budget, we were able to secure the base for community radio and even see it expand. And I think everyone played their role, because I think the community radio community, if you like, took the view, well, we're not going to see a huge bounty of money coming out of this government, but at least we're not going to be pared to the bone, and we'll bring our own creativity and ingenuity to the table if the government will secure the budget.
And what we're talking about here is that part of the Department of Culture, Media and Sport budget that serviced the Community Radio Fund, which was in the region, I think it started off at £500,000, and then it was subject to a little bit of austerity, but by the time you were leaving office, it was secured for, I think, £400,000 until the financial year 2020.
That's right. It was secured about £400,000, so we managed to pretty much protect it. And I think, you know, looking back now in 2017 after the Trump election, which is, this may sound a bit of a leap, but I'll explain why I'm citing Donald Trump, is that, you know, people are much more aware we're in the era of fake news and big American tech companies and massive propaganda and state actors playing fast and loose with our democracy. So, you know, I did a lot of work to see whether we could protect local newspapers, for example. And I'm very pleased that we did our best to protect community radio, because in an era of fake news, it's a bit ironic that local news becomes ever more important. You know, if you've got a local community radio station run by people you probably know talking about what's going on in your community, that's really very important indeed. So I think as we become more globalised and big tech players, whether it's Google or Facebook or Twitter, come to dominate our discourse, we should hold on to something like community radio, which is run by local communities, by people who provide a very professional service and provide local news and support. And also, I know something you're very interested in, provide a skills base. So they provide a route through people in both secondary education and college education, but also adults, to gain important skills that they can use in other professions.
One of the pleasures of working with you a few years ago, Ed, is that you do genuinely have an understanding of these things. And you can't always say that when dealing with ministers or people in politics. But if we were inventing all this now, I mean, what do you think that government could do to support perhaps more the community radio sector?
So I think that there are a number of things. I mean, one of the things we always battled with in community radio and government was regulation. So it was to encourage Ofcom to grant more community radio licences. And also we grappled with the definition of community radio, so not to allow local radio, as it were, whether it was the BBC or commercial radio stations, to impinge too much on community radio licences. So those are two things. So you can certainly have a regulatory environment that encourages community radio stations to get up and running. I think that, although it sounds perverse, sometimes you can have too much money. So if for example, government suddenly arrived at the table with 50 million quid for community radio, I think in a bizarre way, without wishing to put your listeners off, that could be very damaging, because you'd get all sorts of charlatans or whatever getting involved. But I certainly think you can increase the budget. I mean, 400,000 is an absolute drop in the ocean. And if I was always pushing to have more money for community radio, and if you had a budget of 3 or 4 or 5 million, that would make a real difference. And it would show also a degree of intent on the part of government to support this important sector. So I certainly think the regulatory environment is something the government could look at, and budget is something that government could look at. And also, I think, you know, you will see, funny enough, although there are a lot of Tory MPs who will happily slag off the BBC, the minute there's a debate, the minute the BBC, and they're clever like this, the minute they propose cuts to BBC local radio, you'll have a debate in Parliament with 100 MPs turning up, because they all appear on their local radio. And I think MPs themselves should get behind community radio. I don't actually have a community radio station in my constituency, but the more MPs appear, or the more community radio stations encourage their MPs to do interviews, the more they'll get known in Parliament for the important work they do. I know that sounds probably a bit cynical, but That's a very important aspect of that. But broadly speaking, it comes down to a good regulatory environment and a bit more money.
If there was a bit more money, regard it as a social investment. You've just identified, if you just chuck good money at something, it may not necessarily be a good thing. But if it's a social investment, how would you like to see a larger amount of money invested from government into community media to stabilise and grow the sector? What do you think would be the use of that money?
Well, I think, you can invest the money, obviously, in equipment. People need modern and up-to-date equipment. The other thing we wanted to do was to ensure that as we move towards digital radio, that there was a place for community radio on digital stations. So we tasked Ofcom with finding technical solutions for very local broadcasting, which they made great strides on doing. I certainly think, one of the debates we had was about advertising and sponsorship and how community radio could use that. And you want to be as flexible as possible for community radio to be able to raise money from local funds. And then obviously in terms of training and support, I mean, most community radio stations can at the very best probably employ one person. They rely entirely, almost entirely on voluntary support to keep themselves going. So if there was money available to at least subsidise some of the time that people devote to community radio, that would also be a very good thing. So there's a whole way you could use money effectively. And but as I say, although it sounds a bit perverse, sometimes you can have too much money in the sector. Sometimes a little goes a lot way. But pump priming by giving people a base of money and allowing them to go out and then raise other funds is a good way of doing things.
If there was to be a larger amount of money made available, do you see that as being exclusive to the budget of DCMS? Or how do you think community radio or the Community Media Association might develop relationships with other government departments? Would that be something that you would think is a good thing? And is it indeed practical?
Yeah, I think, again, you can use money creatively. And you could certainly say, for example, the skills budget from the Department of Business could be accessed by community radio to, effectively support apprentices and so on working in community radio. You can be creative there. The Department of Education, in terms of supporting skills in community radio. You could look at things like big lottery funding and how that could support community radio, because obviously community radio stations massively support their local community. So you could look at the Department of Communities and Local Government and how they support local initiatives as well. So, I mean, one of the perpetual problems in government is joining up different departments and different budgets. But if you look at community radio as not just being a media sector, but as part of the community sector, the social sector and the skills sector, then you can be creative in how community radio can potentially access other government pots of money.
We could spend all our conversation talking about funding, but I do want to move us off this because, again, last time we met, we were talking about the Community Radio Amendment Order, and unbelievably, it's come round again. So under your watch, it was a five-year rollover for the licence, and we're now coming up to a period where we need to consider how community radio is going to be licensed going forward. One of the reasons for the sort of the ongoing rollover from the first, second and then third term of the licence was waiting for small-scale DAB. Where do you think small-scale DAB is at the moment, and how is it going to impact on the community radio sector?
Well, I am well out of date now because it's a year and a half since I left government. So let me just answer that question by saying what my approach was, which is very simple, which is that I do think that digital radio is the future. I think people who pretend that somehow we can stop it or it's going to be overtaken by internet radio are barking up the wrong tree. I think digital radio is the future, and I have a digital radio in my 15-year-old car. I converted digital radio and I get a lot more stations that I listen to. But the key was obviously that radio is driven by the listener, and I didn't want to leave behind important parts of the radio community. And I wanted to find a way for certainly local radio stations and community radio stations to get a platform on digital radio. And as far as I'm aware, when I left office, Ofcom had found a technical solution that would allow people to get onto small-scale stations, to get onto DAB, which is the answer. So provided you can keep the cost down and potentially support, if you're going for a digital switchover, support community radio stations in terms of buying the equipment they need to make that transition, then I think you found a solution. So I don't know where we are in terms of where we are in digital switchover. As I say, I wanted it to be an organic process. I didn't want it to be a government-led process where you had a big cut-off date and everyone was suddenly going to have to listen to digital radio. But I do think we're fast approaching a tipping point where government can give it a nudge as more and more people listen to digital. But in my view, it's vital that community radio is not left behind.
If the case was made to government that community radio saves the government money, saves the public purse, at one end it clearly does, because it helps people into employment. That's immediately made state savings, and you're turning people from a liability into a contributor to the Treasury. At another end of the scale, we're keeping people out of prison. We're keeping people out of young offenders' institutions, or indeed when they leave those institutions, not reoffending. We're making a contribution there. If we could make that case more clearly, perhaps, than we are to government at the moment, can you see a future where the community radio sector and the third sector, the charity sector, and government might work together to improve the lot for community media in the UK?
Yeah, well, it sort of goes back to my earlier answer about which pots of money community radio can access. So, you know, the Ministry of Justice would be another department that community radio could engage with. So, obviously, helping young people, finding them routes through to employment is very much part of the government's agenda. Taking people who might, for example, find straightforward academic education challenging for all sorts of different reasons and giving them something that really motivates them and excites them is a great opportunity. So again, highlighting this, to a certain extent, it's up to the community radio sector to highlight some of these case studies to show people what they can achieve. But I do think, you know, it is always a challenge for any sector when it's interacting with government to show its widest impact. I've been very involved, for example, with my arts background in showing how the arts can have a massive impact on the health sector. So I do think that there are great opportunities there for community radio to highlight the impact it has across a whole range of different sectors, not just on young people and their opportunities, but in terms of community cohesion, placemaking, identity making, skills, and so on.
Well, if we get that document together, would you quality test it for me?
Of course I will.
And I don't think I'd be doing my job if I didn't ask you this, but do you miss being a minister?
No, not in the slightest. I mean, I think I did the job for 6 years. It was probably time for me to move on. I have a couple of regrets, unfinished business that I would have liked to have carried on. But ultimately, you always know when you take a job like that, it's going to come to an end in some shape or form. And I think to have a run of 6 years is more than I could have expected.
You're rather youthful still in your looks, and you've got a lot to come. Would you like a return to frontline politics, or is it something else for you?
I've always wanted to be Secretary of State for Culture, so at some point, who knows? If I tell you one thing that the change of government has taught me, when you see people like David Davis and Liam Fox back in the cabinet, is that politics is a funny old game, and if you sit tight long enough, sometimes the carousel comes round.
Well, you and I both are on one end of the carousel. We'll see where it all leads.
Thank you very much, Dom. Lovely to see you again.
Ed Vasey there, talking to me at the end of November. And I'm very grateful to him for his time. Now, I do travel far and wide for this podcast, so if there is anybody you would like me to track down and interview who has some bearing on community media or community radio here in the UK, then I'd be very happy to do so. Email me, manager@summervalleyfm.co.uk. This year, I've got to all sorts of parts of the country, and it was back in August that I spent time in the Lancashire region, and I dropped into Chorley FM. I'll bring you that full interview on another edition of the programme. But one of the things I'm really keen to do is to bring you those stories of maximum impact, where people have come into community media organisations and benefited hugely from their training, inclusion and skill development. And when I was talking to Barbara Lowe at Chorley FM, I asked her if any of their trainees had had this kind of experience of dramatic impact.
I can think of several instances where that's happened. We get asked that question quite a lot. What are your greatest successes with people? And you can say that, well, some of them have gone on to commercial radio, which is brilliant, which is fantastic. That's what we're here for as a training station. But one thing really stands out in my book, really, about a young guy who came to Chorley FM. He was around about 17 years of age. Came from a very notorious family, known locally for all the wrong reasons. So we didn't expect too much from this young guy, but he came to us and he wanted to be a presenter here at Chorley FM. Now, talking to him generally, we asked what his plans were for the future, what did he want to do, what kind of employment did he want, and the lad was really not interested in anything remotely like a job. He just didn't want to do a job. It was quite obvious that that's not what his agenda was. But he came to us at Chorley FM. We put him on one of the community shows, and it turned out that this guy, although he had no qualifications, he wasn't doing well at school, he dropped out of school actually, was quite good on the mic. He was very inventive, he did lots of community interviews, and to cut a really long story short, in the end, he ended up getting a job in a local newsagents, which was a massive achievement for someone who just didn't want to work at all. From there, he ended up with a job at a supermarket. He learned to drive. So now he is the manager of that supermarket. He now drives a car. He's got a girlfriend. He's living the dream. He's doing what most people would take for granted. And if I'm ever asked what is the greatest success Chorley FM has ever produced, I would say it's in the top five things that we have ever done, is to get someone who had no prospects in life to actually do something with it and contribute to society.
And what made the difference? He clearly discovered he had a talent, which he then exploited to its potential. But do you think it was just about being in a place where people valued him and he was able to build his own confidence?
I think we gave him a lot of encouragement, which he'd never had before. We played to his strengths rather than his weaknesses. He met a lot of people from the community who influenced him, I think. We also had a lot of young people here at the time who were all going off to university and doing what they did. They would go to the pub in the evening. He couldn't go because he didn't have any money. I think all this, when it was all put together in the pot, he realised he was really missing out by having that attitude, and his attitude changed.
Is he still involved with the station?
He's not. He's not got the time. he's a manager of a supermarket, and he's just doing well for himself, which is fantastic.
Just part of a really enjoyable conversation I had with Barbara there. And later in the programme, we'll hear from Jake Peach and his remarkable story of how he developed a love of radio out of adverse circumstances. But before then, here's Daniel Bruce. And I began our conversation by asking what the purposes of the charity that he works for are.
Internews exists to provide access to news and information for people everywhere that they need to play a meaningful role in their communities, to be able to hold power to account, to make informed decisions for their lives. We're working in 50 to 70 countries this year at any one time, and working to strengthen the media sector and the broadcasting and print and TV media in all of those countries to create more informed societies. We respond to disasters and emergencies by making sure that people have access to what is life-saving information, often in the immediate aftermath of man-made or natural disasters. And we're also keeping alive independent media in the countries where it is the hardest thing to be able to do that, and providing really life-saving support to some of our media partners there.
You're in a very good position then to assess a sort of world scene of grassroots media. And it must be very different. We're talking in Leicester today. It must be very different in Leicester than, say, Sudan.
Well, you know, it is and it isn't, actually. I mean, I think that's the irony. That's kind of, you know, why I'm here and why we're having this conversation. You know, community media the world over, of course, you know, feels and looks different in many ways, but its social outcomes and the reason that it exists around the world is because it is the media, it is the opportunity for citizen voice, it is the opportunity for accountability at the most local level possible, that people crave the world over. And the social impacts are very different and more acute in more acute contexts or more challenging contexts. But actually, you know, the motivations of people to go into community broadcasting or other forms of media, I think, are the same in Zimbabwe, Afghanistan or here in Leicester.
In this country, there's an increasing cynicism of the media in general. I think one of the things when you were talking to the Community Media Association's AGM a few minutes ago, you were saying that there's a cynicism of the media, but there's confidence in my media. You said something along those words.
Yeah, I mean, we find this, again, the world over, is that obviously there's this prevailing narrative now about a collapse in trust in the media, and it's come out of the whole fake news, alternative facts, post-truth era, whatever you want to call it. Actually, I think that's a red herring for a lot of reasons. And we often find people come to us with our experience of international media around the world for over three decades now and say, well, what can we do about these problems? And I think too often the debate is looking at the kind of, you know, sticking plaster solutions, or, you know, how do you get rid of the problems and squash these things down? And actually our answer to that is, well, actually you have to amplify the good stuff. And the good stuff is, again, the media, the access to information, the opportunity for citizen voice that is closest to people where they are. And so often that is community media. And that's why we're saying, to use the words I used earlier, that people don't necessarily trust the media, but they trust their media, the media that truly represents them and where they can have an opportunity to be part of the debate.
In our country, we have, in comparison to many parts of the world, good traditions of freedom of speech and good liberal traditions, so that we won't be persecuted for having our say. But community media, particularly in its radio context, or what we might now describe as grassroots media, has been a growing phenomenon of the last sort of 10, 15 years, I would say. Where would you say, from your position at Internews, we are in the UK with established media vis-a-vis independent and grassroots media?
You know, it's been a whirlwind few decades, I think, hasn't it? If you think back to the birth of commercial radio in this country, you know, off the back of the pirate radio stations, which actually in the grand scheme of things wasn't that long ago. You know, LBC starting out in whatever it was, the early 1970s, and then we saw this dramatic rise in commercial radio and editorial confidence in that sector, and some amazing programme making, which by and large isn't there anymore because of consolidation, because of economic pressure and so on and so forth. If you look at the local news industry, printed press, there are newspapers folding all over the place, and, you know, a real collapse in journalism and content production at a local level. And I think that the community sector, the community media sector in this country, is and has to be part of the antidote to those problems. So whilst we are not living in a repressive regime for freedom of expression compared to some of the other places that we work in, we're working in a very economically challenged environment for content production, for the media sector generally, for local journalism in particular. And I think we should be concerned about that. I think it is far harder now than it was 10 years ago to find out with a reasonable degree of confidence in your information sources what is happening at the end of your own street, as opposed to what's happening in the nearest big city to you.
Is one of the solutions then to that challenge that you've identified to work out strategies to grow and sustain community media or grassroots media organisations?
Absolutely, yes. And I think there's a risk that sometimes people look at, you know, radio as being a bit old-fashioned, or even the concept of community media as being old-fashioned. And actually, I think in this country, I think the evidence suggests quite the contrary. There is a vibrant, significant body of the population here that still listen to radio at least once a week, or more often than not, every day. What I think we need is greater kind of cross-media innovation. So again, that we can meet people where they are and, for example, have a more ubiquitous presence for community media online through social media channels and so on and so forth, so that you're starting to bring in the digital natives, if you like, and that building the reputation of community media as a credible source of debate, as a credible source of information about local communities in a variety of different ways, is going to be absolutely critical. But I think there is this body of people who've been represented here today in these hundreds of radio stations and online and TV stations up and down the country, where there is so much potential, which I think could be unlocked in a tremendous way over the coming years.
Daniel, we first met at UNESCO conference in Paris, I think just over 2 years ago. That's set in train levels of communication between Internews and the Community Media Association. Where is that relationship now, and how do you see it developing?
I think we've been very wise to take our time in having a detailed and thoughtful conversation between two partners who until that point hadn't worked together before, but we could see that our interests align. And as Lucinda, the CMA chair, was saying today, you know, if you put the strategy of the global strategy of Internews on the table next to the strategy of the CMA, our joint recognition of the power of information, media and communication to change lives for the better is very plain to see. So what we want to be able to do is to really draw off each other's expertise to be able to contribute something in the UK sector. For us, this would be our first domestic programme in the UK, which would be very different when we're used to working in very different contexts with very different challenges around the world. But it's clear that we feel we have something to bring in terms of that expertise from all of those different countries, 100 countries over the last 35 years. And we feel that the CMA and its members, as I said earlier, are so well poised to make such a significant social impact with extra support at the centre. And I think that's where, you know, we can and should act at this point. And so we've been talking around a strategy that has three principal pillars around support to incisive content production, the economics of the sector and the role of the CMA itself. And we are cautiously optimistic that we will have more to report on that and maybe, you know, some form of announcement next year.
Well, Daniel, it's great talking to you today. We first met when I was on CMA Council, and as of today, I'm now back on it. So I'm looking forward to ongoing conversations with Internews. But for the moment, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dom, and congratulations on being back on the Council as well. Thank you.
Always a joy talking to Daniel Bruce from Internews and sharing ideas. And I couldn't be more pleased that Internews are starting to work with the Community Media Association. Inevitably, our conversation did drift in that direction because I was actually talking to him at the CMA's AGM. Part of that AGM is the election to the Governing Council, and as you probably gathered, I was elected back onto it after an absence of 2 years. So I'm very much looking forward to working with the Community Media Association again from within its Governing Council. Now, you might recall in my last outing of Third Sector on In Radio, we were dwelling in Sheerness and having great conversations at Sheppey FM. Well, it was whilst I was over in the East Country that I decided to extend my visit and thereby extending my community radio tour. And I had a very happy couple of days in Kent, including popping into one of those student community radio station fusions, that is CSR FM, a radio station that has incidentally done very well in both the Community Radio Awards and the Student Radio Awards, both of which have taken place during the autumn. Here I met Jake Peach. I should say re-met him because I'd actually interviewed him as part of my broadcast from the Community Radio Awards when we were all down in Bristol in September. But he showed me round the radio station on the university campus, and I'll bring you that fuller conversation on a future edition of the programme. But whilst I was talking to him, it was very clear that this is a guy going places in the radio industry, and I wanted to know where it all came from.
So my passion and love for radio comes really from quite a traumatic experience. It was whilst I was in hospital, was ill at the age of 11 with cancer, and I found a love in radio through Radio Lollipop. Started going down there a few times and really loved it a lot. Leading up to that point, before I was diagnosed, I had, as a kid, I was just, and I still am, and nothing's changed, but at that point in time I was really sort of wondering, you know, what I wanted to do with life. And it's sort of at that age where you're kind of a bit doubtful of what angle or what area you want to take or what road you want to go down. And I knew it was some performance sense. I was always talking a lot, chatting a lot, asking loads of questions and being very performative and stuff like that. And people said, oh, you'll end up singing or acting one day or something like that. But I didn't quite figure out, you know, what it was for me, what I really wanted to do. So I knew I loved music. I always listened to so much music through both my parents and all my family when I was younger, whether that be like sort of Earth, Wind and Fire of the 80s or Jamiroquai or something like the 90s when I was growing up. I sort of found in this really bad experience of being in hospital, I found that these two experiences merged together and sort of blended into a love for radio. And I was like, okay, so I can talk a lot here. I also also share my passion and my enjoyment for music in radio. So then I explored it a little bit after that, started to read up on radio a little bit. And the presenting side came from giving public speeches for Great Ormond Street Charity about my experience in hospital. I gained a lot of my public speaking confidence there. I see it as sort of no different just being behind a mic instead. So that really helped my confidence in that sense and broadcasting myself, I guess.
You found yourself in some very adverse situations. No child should have to spend time in hospital, and cancer is a terrible thing. But it seems to me that some benefit has come out of that awful experience.
It has. I mean, I think my attitude in life was, no matter what, even in that situation, was to be positive and go through it, because I wasn't going to come out the other side with not having that positivity and that view of it was going to go well.
Your story, Jake, seems to me to be one of a positive outcome from a really negative and terrible experience. Is that the way you see it?
It is completely to the nail, really. I mean, I never would have expected radio in particular to be... It wasn't a saviour for me, I would say, but it was definitely indirectly at the point in my life where I wasn't sure of what I wanted to do in a performing sense. I always knew I wanted to do something along those lines. And then sort of the combination of music and talking a lot and showing a passion for myself and expressing myself came through radio. And it was through a really traumatic experience in what may seem strange to people that I actually found myself at what I wanted to do career-wise. And I'd never expected that in a million years to be the way it happened. But like life, it sort of things do just happen, really, and you sort of just go with the flow. And in that time of trauma, something good came out of it. Something good had to come out of it. If something good didn't come out of it, then I probably wouldn't be sitting here where I am today and doing what I love.
And there he was, doing the thing he loves and doing it rather well. And perhaps that's all any of us can hope for, is to be doing the thing that we love. And our roots into radio may be multifarious, but for me and the hundreds of people that find themselves on the end of my third sector microphone, it is, of course, wonderful to be working in this industry. And Jake's story there bringing us a fitting crescendo to this edition of the programme. Do contact me with your ideas and feedback on manager@summervalleyfm.co.uk, summer spelt S-O-M-E-R, as you'd expect, really, from a Somerset-based location, or my office line is 01761 568 004. And whilst I look forward to hearing from you, you'll be hearing from me again very soon.
This is the radio industry's very own radio station. 24/7 in radio.